welcome to this Thursday edition of Main Street. I'm Craig Blumenschein. After the break in today's show, Matt Olien will stop by and take us to the movies. This week, Matt reviews the movie The Outrun, and it may be a difficult watch for some. And Dave Thompson and I will review the news and summarize all five ballot measures that we'll all be voicing our opinions on at the ballot box on Tuesday, November 5th. But first, every October, in recognition of Domestic Violence Awareness Month, organizations and individuals unite across the country for a national effort to uplift the needs, voices, and experiences of survivors. Today on Main Street, we'll visit with leaders from the North Dakota Domestic and Sexual Violence Coalition. Amy Britz, she's the communications coordinator. Seth O'Neill, he's the executive director. And Kayla Jones is a domestic violence program coordinator for the North Dakota Domestic and Sexual Violence Coalition.
Welcome, all of you, to Main Street.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
This is such an important topic to discuss. And I want to start maybe by defining the issue for North Dakota. What do the statistics say about sexual and domestic violence right here in our state? What are the trends? And if we know, what are the causes?
This is Kayla. And in North Dakota in 2023, our member organizations served over 6,000 victims of domestic violence. And along with those over 6,000 victims, they provided services to over 4,200 children that were also impacted by these incidents. Nationally, we know that 1 in 4 women experience domestic violence and 1 in 7 men will experience domestic violence in their lifetime.
I think people listening might be surprised that men also experience domestic violence, and by those numbers, are our statistics in this state below per capita statistics, a little higher? What do we know about?
So this is Kayla again. We know that women are experiencing violence at a higher rate. And so in North Dakota in 2023, our member organizations reported that 83% of the victims that they provided services to were women.
How do we rank nationally? Do we know? Or do we have a larger problem, not quite as bad? Do we have an idea?
This is Amy. That's something that's really tricky to measure just because we're working with different state populations. You know, Dakota is a larger state geographically, but we might have a smaller population than a state that might be smaller geographically. So it's really tricky to compare apples to apples. It's really hard to say where we rank compared to other states, but we do know that domestic violence is happening in North Dakota. We know that for sure.
One is too many.
Yes, exactly. So, and we like to say everyone knows someone who has experienced domestic violence. And so that's something that we're really trying to address here today.
Seth, if I were to ask you what the mission of North Dakota Domestic and Sexual Violence Coalition is, what would you tell me?
Craig, that's a good question. This is Seth. And our mission is to end domestic and sexual violence in North Dakota. And we're a statewide organization. And so we work across the state with our member organizations. And our primary goal is to make sure that violence stops and that we can end violence altogether.
So the grand question is, how do you go about that?
That's a good question. We do that in a lot of different ways. We provide training to different groups, whether that be law enforcement or, you know, court personnel. We support our local member organizations in the direct services work that they're doing. We advocate at the Capitol during the legislative session for policies that we think will work towards that goal of ending violence.
So if someone's in crisis this moment, what should they do?
So this is Kayla. There in North Dakota, there are 20 member organizations that will provide services to people that are experiencing violence. And that information is available on our website. It's nddf.org. And people that are looking for help are able to interact with a map in order to find where those organizations are. And as soon as they connect with an organization, they will be connected with an advocate that would be able to help them any way that they're needing help, whether if that's they're looking to end that relationship or learn how to be safer while staying in that relationship, or if they're looking for help with getting the court involved, whether that's with criminal charges or with civil orders of protection. really, we just, help is really personalized to the person that's coming to seek it.
If anyone is having a crisis that's an emergency, they should certainly dial 911 right this moment. Wouldn't you agree?
Yes, it can be. That can be a safe option for people. Sometimes in certain circumstances, contacting law enforcement might put that person in more danger. So it really depends on the circumstances. And I like to say that some people that are experiencing violence or victims of violence are the experts on their safety. And so they really know what's the best thing for them to do. But 911 is also a valid option.
Kayla, can we drill down on that just a little bit? That's surprising to me that contacting law enforcement directly oftentimes may not be the best option.
We know that people that are abusive to their partners are often often a master of their craft. I like to say it that way, because they can look one way to the public, and it's usually like this put together person, and they can be a completely different person behind closed doors. And so sometimes when law enforcement is called after a violent incident has happened, what can happen is they flip a switch, and their abusive person would flip a switch where all of a sudden they're not the person that looks out of control, their victim is. And so law enforcement arrives on scene and sees that this woman, typically a woman, is hysterical, and because she just experienced this horrific thing, and he's over here looking very calm, collected, put together. He's saying, I have no idea what's happening. She's just like this. And so sometimes we see women getting arrested because they may have used resistive violence, or sometimes we see social services then getting involved in their lives, and which can just be really scary for a victim that's experienced violence, and that fear of their children being removed from their care and already being placed with an abusive parent. And so there's just... So that's why sometimes calling law enforcement isn't the safest option.
That's surprising, but I think I understand.
This is Amy. Just to add to what Kayla was saying, I think what we see sometimes is with abusive partners as well, is what they're trying to do is maintain this power and control over the victim. And so oftentimes they're trying to, like Kayla mentioned, make them seem crazy or make them seem like they are the ones that are causing the violence. And really what it is a front. And so I think in the situation that Kayla was talking about, when a law enforcement officer might arrive on the scene, they might see a totally different situation than what that victim just really went through. And, you know, the law enforcement officer, they don't know that, you know what I mean? Like they weren't there. They just know what's in front of them. And so I think that's where situations can become tricky for someone just then arriving on the scene.
The grass is green outside. The house is kept and put together. There's nothing to see here. And certainly that can not be the case. So when someone then reaches out to connect to some of the advocates that you've talked about, what should they expect? What happens next?
So this is Kayla. When somebody starts talking with an advocate, the first thing to expect is that advocate really just wants to have a really good understanding of what that person has gone through, because the reason they want that understanding is because they want to know where to refer them for services, or what kind of things that they can offer this person, what type of services they can offer this person. So an example of services is, if you have a person coming in that hasn't received medical care for injuries that were caused, an advocate can then refer them to a medical center for whatever medical needs they might have. Or if they need help filling out Medicaid applications, an advocate can help them with that. An advocate also can help get the court involved if that person is wanting to get that order of protection. So again, it's really just personalized to what that person needs. Victims just aren't the same. They have different needs. And so it's really that personalized plan, that personalized response.
There are many different types of domestic violence, and I think oftentimes it gets lumped together in that one phrase, a one size fits all. What are the different forms of domestic violence that exist?
This is Kayla. So we know domestic violence, we know the physical assault stuff. We know that a punch, a hit, a kick, those are all physical violence. We also know that there's emotional violence that can happen. And so that could be name calling, putting them down, calling them stupid, or just messing with their brain. We also know that there's economic or financial abuse. And so that looks like an abusive partner having control over all the money in their relationship, or not allowing their partners to have a job or go to school to better their careers. And then we know that there's spiritual abuse, and that could be an abusive partner limiting their ability to practice a religion in the way that they want to. So that could be denying them going to church or practicing in different cultural activities that you would have, which leads into the cultural abuse. That could be destroying cultural items that might be important to that person. And then there's coercive control as well, which is it gets kind of complicated. And this is like the more covert tactic that an abusive person will use. And so this is isolating that person, making it more convenient to not be around friends or family. Because if they're hanging out with friends or family, they're over here just causing a scene. And so eventually it's just easier for them to just be with that abusive partner. And then they dismantle a support system. Or there's gaslighting is a new buzzword that we're seeing a lot lately. I never said that you're crazy. And so this really does, over a period of time, really makes a person wonder if they are crazy. It really creates a lot of doubt. Like, was that a violent act? Did I cause that violent act? It really just makes them evaluate what they know was true, what they know happened, but it causes a lot of confusion internally. And this is where we see stalking and threats to cause violence or damaging property.
We're enjoying our conversation, and it's a difficult one, and it's sad that we have to have this conversation, quite frankly. But still, I'm appreciative of the information. We're talking to Amy Ritz. Amy is the communications coordinator for the North Dakota Domestic and Sexual Violence Coalition. Kayla Jones is the domestic violence program coordinator. And Seth O'Neill is the executive director. And Seth, how are you funded? How do you get resources to do what you do?
Yeah, that's a great question, Craig. We're primarily grant funded through a mixture of federal and state grants. And so we receive federal grants to the U.S. Department of Justice, and then we receive different state funding as well. We do receive a small portion of, private donations, which we really appreciate those. And so we're funded through a variety of funding sources. And, our main mission is to support these member organizations that ultimately do the direct service work. And so we, serve as a coalition that represents those different programs.
Amy, how do you get the word out? Will you speak at different events if folks want you to talk about the subject? Are you available? What do you do to let folks know that, hey, this is really an issue right here in North Dakota?
Yes, great question. This is Amy. Well, first things first, we go on Main Street. That's where we start. We use many different channels to get the word out. We are active on social media. We are always trying to get in the news cycle and talking about different aspects of our work and how we can help domestic violence victims out in North Dakota. So news media, social media. We also are a part, we coordinate statewide awareness campaigns. So October is actually Domestic Violence Awareness Month. And we are in the middle of October right now. So that's very exciting. So one thing that we're doing is we are coordinating a Domestic Violence Awareness Month campaign. And that involves all of our member organizations. And our member organizations are 19 domestic violence and sexual assault advocacy centers across the state. And so one thing that we've done to really bring them in and get the word out about domestic violence is we've coordinated this campaign where we've sent out tote bags and stickers with all these awareness messages about domestic violence and messages about positive relationships and how we can get victims the supportive services that they may want. So really awareness campaigns, social media, news media, our website. Yeah, there's many different channels that we use.
Kayla, I want to drill down on something you said earlier because I've thought about it. You said that there are economic, constraints or threats that are used against men or women to make them stay in a relationship. If I am someone who would like to get out, but am thinking, I can't afford anything. I couldn't afford to go to the store and buy a sandwich. I couldn't afford a place to live. I couldn't afford a drink of water. What would you tell them?
Craig, that's a really good question. And unfortunately, something that a lot of people experience. You said not even, you can't even afford a sandwich. How on earth are you going to put down a deposit in first month's rent? So there's different things that that advocates have available to help people, whether they have victim assistance money through their own organization. So here at the North Dakota Domestic and Sexual Violence Coalition, we were granted an all-state foundation grant specifically designed to help people with their economic security and economic empowerment. And so they can get connected through these funds going through an advocacy organization to be able
and
to
then
help
also
them.
What would we tell listeners who are worried about what we talked about earlier, the he said, she said scenario where the police officer or someone comes up, hey, this is a problem for me, this is awful, and the other person says, are you kidding me? What, she's nuts. I don't know what she's talking about. So in that situation, what should people think about? Because they don't want to get into just another he said, she said situation with someone. How can that be prevented?
Sure. Great question, Craig. I think the best way to help people with that is really getting connected to that advocate program, getting connected to an advocate that has relationships built with law enforcement and can sit with them and sit with victims while they're being interviewed by law enforcement. The unfortunate truth is that he said, she said is always going to be a factor, and an advocate can help a victim understand that they know the truth, they know what happened, and as long as they find that and trust themselves that they know what happened, the outside influence, such as from law enforcement or from their community, isn't going to matter as much as long as they know their own truth, and so they seeking that validation from themselves and that their advocate believe them and fully support
what
them.
What warning signs should people be on the lookout for individually that could indicate that my relationship is going to become abusive, or my good friend or my sister or sister-in-law, that their relationship may become abusive? What should we be watching for? And then I'm going to ask you, and then what should we do if we notice some of those signs with a loved one?
Again, really good question. Early warning signs that we see with people that are abusive in a relationship is you might see somebody that wants to move too quickly, such as move in together within a month, or saying, I love you within a couple of weeks, or you're my soulmate, nobody understands you like I do. Or you'll see somebody not respecting your boundaries. If you're saying, I don't want calls after 10 o'clock, but then they're calling you every night at 11:30 to talk to you, that's not respecting a boundary. Or if somebody is controlling you, saying you can't go here, or you can't go there, you can't hang out with this person. And so when we're seeing these early warning signs, sometimes it's hard for that person that's in it, in that relationship to see them. And so what we can do as family or friends that are seeing our loved ones experience this is just have a really good conversation with our friends, like really confront them saying, hey, I noticed that your partner is really limiting. I've noticed that your partner is wanting to move in with you and you guys really haven't been together that long. And I also noticed that they call you a lot while we're out together. And I'm just concerned about you. Know that I'm here for you if you need my support.
Why should we talk about domestic violence rather than just sweeping it under the table? We had this conversation last month when we talked about suicide, horrible topic to talk about. And oftentimes we in the Midwest or the West are told, buck up, deal with it. Come on, this is not anyone else's problem but your own. Just get it together. Why is it important for us to really pay attention and talk about this problem?
This is Amy. I think it's really important to talk about domestic violence because one of the things that we see from abusive partners is this pattern of trying to isolate the victim and really cut them off from their support systems. And they often try to frighten the victim as well into thinking that they have no choice but to stay in this abusive relationship. And so I think that by talking about domestic violence, we can kind of help victims see that they're not alone. They do have support systems out there. There are people out there that can help them navigate their options, that can help them stay safe. And so I think that just by having these conversations and by learning more about domestic violence, by talking about it, we can increase our understanding of what it is and what it looks like, and help victims know that there is help for them. They don't have to stay in these relationships if they don't want to, or if they do want to stay in these relationships, there are ways for them to stay safe. There are ways for them to navigate their situation and live their life in the way that they want to, and not under the control of another person. And so I think just by talking about it, we're really letting people know that they're not alone.
And I would just add, Craig, to that, that it's everyone's problem. I think that, you know, it's not something just between two people. You know, especially in North Dakota, we have that sense of strong community. And so we should care about, you know, what our neighbors are experiencing. And so it's everyone's, you know, responsibility to make sure that their neighbors are being cared for. And so we should talk about it so that everyone kind of has a role in preventing and ending domestic violence.
Kayla, you were going to hop in.
Yeah, I want to say that, again, everyone knows someone who has experienced domestic violence. And when we talk about domestic violence and we help bring awareness and education to it, we uplift the voices of those survivors that have experienced it. We're not going to let their voices be silenced. And that's the biggest thing that we can do for people that have experienced.
Another thing that I thought about, there might be folks who need a lot of help to get through this, not just a place to live, or not just a couple bucks for tomorrow's meal, or not just daycare for a week, and not just job training or more education. They might need all of those things to really start to help themselves with their life, to get out of the domestic violence situation or the sexual violence situation that they are in. Again, what's the message?
So this is Kayla. Yeah. People need all of those things. An advocate relationship with a victim is something that is a very beautiful thing. Advocates will go, we can go with people to their medical appointments and sit there and hold their hand while they're receiving medical care. Advocates will sit there while they're talking to social services about their what's going on with their children. Advocates can go to the school with them, well, whether it's school for themselves to try to figure out how they're going to get their own schedule rearranged, or if it's schools for their children, how are we going to make sure these kids are safe and this victim parent is safe? And so that relationship with that advocate can, like I said, is just a very beautiful thing. And so really lean on your advocates for help, not just for victims, but also if you're a friend or a family member of a person that is experiencing violence, you yourself can call an advocate and learn best ways to support.
So I'm wondering
that
if folks are thinking right now, okay, yeah, that's all well and good for the folks who live in Bismarck or Minot or Fargo. There's lots of support from lots of different organizations for people that live in these larger areas. But shoot, I live 30 miles north of Bowman. There's nothing here to help me. Or is there?
Yeah, Craig, that's a good point. So as we mentioned earlier, we have 19 member organizations, and we cover the whole state. And so no matter where you are, you can receive services. So there's 19 physical locations, but we also have mobile. Some of the organizations have mobile advocates, so they might meet someone at a safe space, you know, in town or wherever they could find them. And so we also, those organizations aren't just in the larger communities. You know, there's an organization in Washburn, you know, in Ellendale, in Grafton, Williston, everywhere across the state. And so no matter where you are listening or where you're located, you can receive help and support.
Amy, I'll give you the last word. For people that need more information and they need it now, where should they go?
Yes. If you are looking for more information, or if you are looking to find an advocate or find an advocacy organization near you, please go to our website. That is nddsvc.org.
That's Amy Britz. She's the communications coordinator for the North Dakota Domestic and Sexual Violence Coalition. Also with us today has been Seth O'Neill. He's the executive director of the North Dakota Domestic and Sexual Violence Coalition, and the train in the background. And Kayla Jones, she's a domestic violence program coordinator, also for the North Dakota Domestic and Sexual Violence Coalition. To all of you, first, thanks for the work that you're doing. And thank you also for joining us on Main Street.
Thanks, Craig.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Support for Brave Public is provided by Basin Electric Power Cooperative.
a consumer-owned generation and transmission cooperative, and owner of a large coal-based carbon capture project in Beulah, North Dakota, with over 35 million metric tons of CO2 captured.
Extra, extra, read all about it. Gather round, everybody.
That's the tune that welcomes Dave Thompson to Main Street each and every Thursday to review the news. Of course, Dave Thompson is our longtime news director here at Prairie Public. Dave, how are you?
I'm doing well, Craig. How are you?
I'm doing good, Dave. Man, election season it's almost upon us. At the tail end of our segment here, we're going to review each and every ballot measure. There's two that have gotten a lot of oxygen. We'll talk about those in just a moment. But Dave, first in our review of the news, Dave, the Office of Legal Immigration says it expects results by the end of the biennium was your headline. What are results, Dave, from that office?
Well, basically, that they've been set up to recruit legal immigrants to come fill jobs in North Dakota. And they said it would probably happen by the end of the biennium. And later in the presentation, they said, well, we could see some of these healthcare nurses or healthcare workers, maybe up to 50 of them, come by the end of this calendar year. So they're a little ahead of the game, but they really do want to continue to attract legal immigrants to come to North Dakota because of the jobs.
So, Dave, this office has helped with immigrants who are then working in the oil field industry, now the nursing segment.
Mm-hmm.
Are there other segments, Dave, that are really looking forward to having this office assist them?
Construction, manufacturing, agriculture are all segments that are looking for workers right now. And they're saying that they may be able to recruit talent. That's why they want to change the name to a global talent organization.
Dave, let's move on. No charges were filed in a shooting at a West Fargo church. Those of us here in Fargo have kind of followed this story.
And it's basically Donald Barron, who apparently shot and killed another man outside a church in West Fargo, acted in self-defense. Apparently, the person who got killed was harassing somebody else who was a church member. It looks like self-defense won out on that one.
All right, Dave, you'll be reporting a little bit later today. For the first time, North Dakota reported no serious accidents in road construction sites this year.
That's right, and no fatalities, which is nice. And DOT is crediting the traveling public with heeding the warnings and heeding, you know, the slowdown signs in construction zones. And they said it's been fairly accident-free. They've had a few accidents, but nothing really serious, no serious injuries, no fatalities.
It can be devastating, and we just remind people to slow down in construction zones. A great friend of mine's son, Dave, was coming home from school at the University of Iowa two Christmases ago, stopped at a construction zone at night, and was rear-ended by somebody who had not even hit the brakes yet. And, of course, it impacts now the rest of his life. So this is a serious, serious thing for us to be cognizant of.
It certainly is. And I've noticed it in my travels, you know, across North Dakota, that people are more respectful of those signs and more respectful of the workers and, you know, making sure they slow down and drive safely through that. And one thing that they talked about was putting your phone down while you're driving through construction zones. And I think a lot of people are doing that.
Well, let's encourage folks to put their phones down anytime they're driving there.
Absolutely.
Maybe I want to have a little bit of a review here. We teased it at the top of our segment about the ballot measures that people will see and are starting to see now for those that are voting early on North Dakota's general election ballot. There aren't just two measures. There are five in numerical order. Constitutional Measure 1 is probably the least, I guess, contentious. It just relates to terminology describing public institutions. Is that right?
Right. That is correct. Because, for example, in the Constitution, the Grafton State School is called the State School for the Feeble-Minded. They wanted to say, this is the Grafton State School for people with developmental disabilities, which is more the correct term on that. The Jamestown State Hospital was the Jamestown State Hospital for the Criminally Insane. Now they're talking with mental illness. So these are the kind of things that are modernizing language, making it less judgmental and maybe more to the point of what these institutions do.
All states go through this process. This is nothing new for sure.
They do.
Dave, Constitutional Measure 2 changes the process for approving initiated constitutional amendments. Tell us more about that.
Right. Normally, you'd get a constitutional amendment on a ballot. You'd vote on it once. You'd say yay or nay. What the legislature did is say there's going to be one vote first, then the legislature will review it, and then would put it back on the ballot for a second vote. There are other states that are doing this, but already you're seeing a ramp up of the opposition to this measure. I've seen that saying, you know, you're taking away the one vote, you know, thing in the Constitution.
What's the reasoning, Dave, that people believe that's a good thing to vote on these measures twice?
Well, number one, there's been some concern among legislators about out-of-state interests who are putting stuff on the North Dakota ballot. They say it's too easy for an out-of-state firm or out-of-state interest to put something on the North Dakota Constitution ballot. And the thing they point to are things like Marcy's Law, which was from Southern California, and now it's in the Constitution, and some other things that have happened.
Constitutional Measure 3, Dave, talks about spending related to the legacy fund. Mm. There's been discussion about that. Many folks accurately say that, look, North Dakota's got a lot of money in the bank. What does this do relative to the legacy fund, or what would it do if it passes?
Basically, what it would do is that you could spend no more than 5% of the principal on the fund. It takes a two-thirds vote of each house of the legislature to do that. It used to be 15%, but now they made it 5% because they really, a number of legislators have said they want to keep that for that rainy day fund where it was designed to be. And when the oil dries up, the natural gas is gone, they want something, you know, a sovereign wealth fund to continue some of the spending that took place during the days of the oil production. When the fund was first set up, they didn't think it was going to get where it is right now, which is well over $10 billion. So if you took a 15% from a smaller fund, like a $5 billion, maybe 5% would be closer to that, you know, in terms of dollar amounts. Really doesn't have any fiscal impact per se at this point. But if they do need to do something for an emergency, they need to get that two-thirds vote of both the House and Senate.
Measure 4 has gotten a lot of oxygen in our state, and this has to do with whether property taxes can continue to be levied based on the assessed valuation of property. So if this passes, essentially property taxes will disappear. If it doesn't pass, then things go on as they are today. This is a measure that impacts everyone, Dave.
It does impact everyone. And if you listen to local governments, they don't want to lose this power because they'd have to go to the legislature with hat in hand. And as was quoted of the mayor of Minot saying, I'm not trusting anybody with my wallet. Do you think I'd trust it to Bismarck? So that's the argument they have. But the legislature has tried on several occasions to do something about property tax relief. They've gone, you know, rebates, and they've gone to the homestead credit, expanding that. But there are a lot of people who think that there needs to be something more done. If this fails, there are legislators who say we need to sit down and figure out how to prevent property taxes from going up so far. Now, the one thing that I've heard, Craig, is that they may want to do away with this idea of levying mills and actually refer to this as dollar amounts. So that may clear up some confusion.
Dave, we're going to have a debate about this on Main Street next Wednesday.
Looking forward to that. That should be interesting.
Aaron Burst, who's the executive director of the North Dakota Association of Counties, will be arguing against passing the property tax measure, measure number 4. And then Dr. Rick Becker, a former legislator, will be arguing that passing Measure 4 will be a good idea. So we're looking forward to that conversation. That's coming up on Wednesday, October 23rd, right here on Main Street. Dave, and then we have initiated Measure number 5, and this measure creates now, or legalizes, I should say, recreational cannabis and provides related regulation. What should we know about that?
What we know about that is that the supporters say states around us in Canada are legalizing it. Minnesota has, South Dakota apparently is through the process, and Montana is looking at the process, and in Canada it's legalized, and they're saying we ought to do this because it's coming in anyway. Now that's one point. Number two, then they say they could, you know, tax, you know, legalized cannabis. But the opponents are saying, hey, it's just one other thing, and law enforcement is against it. The medical community is against it right now. They say that it may cause more harm than good. So this is an interesting measure. I don't know how I feel about it personally, and I will tell you something, that I don't use it, so I don't think I'll use it if it gets legal, but if it's up to somebody in their home, I don't know. It's just one of those things.
Dave, I'm not going to play my hand either, but I can tell you that my wife and I disagree on whether or not this is a good idea.
Oh, okay.
In our home. So, yeah.
I hope it's a civil disagreement.
Oh, it is. Very civil discussions about it. Again, I don't want to tip my hand on what I'm thinking about it, but I can tell you it's caused discussion in our family. And I'm sure that many North Dakotans are wondering about the impact of this, as you say, because everyone around us, it seems like, now has cannabis that is legal in their state.
Opponents have got this Nope on Dope campaign, too. So
that's like the Just Say No campaign, maybe,
pretty much.
The Reagan years.
Yep.
All right, Dave, let's summarize how we're going to cover the election on Tuesday, November 5th here at Prairie Public. What can our listeners expect to hear from your group, Dave?
Well, we'll be all hands on deck, and we're going to be following the main races in North Dakota. The network, of course, NPR, is going to be doing the presidential campaigns, but we'll be following the main races and have results and comments from the candidates all night, and also we'll be looking at all those measures. So it's going to be a long night, but it is. Election nights are a long night, and we're prepared for it.
Looking forward to that coverage, Dave. And then the following day, which is going to be Wednesday, then November 6th, on Main Street, we'll also reflect on the election. Dave, you'll be my guest, and we'll talk about some of the local results. And then I'll also visit with Dr. Michael Patrick Cullinane from Dickinson State University. Our listeners know he's a very talented presidential historian, and he'll have a lot to say about the results of the presidential race. Should we know them by then, which I guess might be a question that we're all thinking about.
It is a question, but we'll have at least preliminary results and maybe at least an idea of the way it's going, but who knows? In the current political climate, we just don't know.
I'm actually nervous about it, Dave, which is odd, but I just feel nervous about it. All right, Dave, what else are you and your team working on?
I have a fun story I'm going to let you know about. You probably don't know the name Hal Rosenbluth, or do you?
I do not.
He had a travel agency in Philadelphia. During the late 1980s, we had that severe drought, and North Dakota was probably the most affected by severe drought. So he brought his call centers to Linton to kind of help, hire some of the farm spouses to work in the call centers. And he expanded through other cities in North Dakota. He's out of that business now, but now he's looking at healthcare. So I've got a story about his moving to North Dakota, and then now his new book that deals with healthcare and what we should do as a society to see that we have better healthcare.
We visit with Dave Thompson, our news director here at Prairie Public, each and every Thursday here on Main Street. Dave, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Greg.
More Main Streets ahead. Stay with us.
Gather around, everybody. I'm gonna tell you a story about a little fella.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Starian Bank, determined to provide smart banking solutions with innovative checking accounts and personal banking tools that match your lifestyle. Starian, taking you farther. Learn more at StarianBank.com.
Our weekly fanfare, that means it's time for Matt Olean to join us in the Main Street studio. Matt, welcome back to Main Street.
Hi, Craig.
We review movies each and every Thursday. This Thursday is no exception, Matt, and this week's movie is The Outrun. Let's listen to the trailer.
Sometimes you can feel a vibration in Orkney, a low rumble. It takes over the whole island and every part of your body. There is only so much height any wave can sustain before it comes crashing down. I'm sorry.
I can't hear you say that again. I wish you were a completely different person.
The urge to drink can come out of nowhere. You think you're doing well. Suddenly you want nothing more than a drink.
All right, Matt, we've heard the trailer. This is a story that might hit hard to some, maybe, and seems pretty intense to me. The movie is called The Outrun. What did you think of it, Matt?
I liked it, didn't love it. The main problem is it's 20 minutes too long. This movie pushes the two-hour limit. It's like an hour and 59 minutes. And at some point, you feel like it's kind of repeating itself. So let me kind of set it up, though. Saoirse Ronan, wonderful actress, of course, and this is really an actor's piece, what this movie is. It's, she's an alcoholic. She's trying to get her life back in order as she goes back to her home, which she was raised on the Orkney Islands near Scotland, if you're familiar with that, Craig. And she's, you know, there's a lot of flashbacks to her time in London when she's fallen down drunk in bars, and she ruins her relationship with her boyfriend, wonderfully played by Papa Esiudu, is his name. And so it's really told in kind of a disjointed fashion, which I liked, and I like the cinematography too. I think what makes this movie at least good is Ronan's performance. We've never seen her give a performance like this. She's a wonderful actress, but I've never seen her kind of portray a character like this, of kind of this falling down drunk. She's a aspiring a medical student who screws that up because of her alcoholism. And the scenes of showing her falling down drunk and screwing up her life and all that stuff is really well done. The cinematography is excellent. The flashbacks within, when I say flashbacks, Craig, so what you see is she's back at the Orkney Islands. She's living with her mother, talking to her father. Really nice supporting performances by the actors who play her parents. Saskia Reeves plays her mother. Stefan Dillon plays her dad, who suffers from bipolar disorder. And that's a key kind of cog in this movie, kind of the passing down of mental illness. And she tries to rebuild her life by going home and kind of working for this nature preserve on a nearby island where they're trying to bring back a certain bird that has not migrated back to the island. So she's kind of finding this outdoor isolation work very, very nice. But through that, she's trying to keep her sobriety, and it's difficult. You know, any film like this, there's going to be setbacks. So I think what really makes the film is the cinematography, the setting. You know, we're not used to seeing films by the Orkney Islands in Scotland. We're used to seeing alcohol movies in LA or New York or Chicago or whatever. And so, and her performance is just amazing. It's a tremendous performance. She's probably going to get an Oscar nomination. But in the end, I felt the last half hour kind of kept repeating itself. We were kind of seeing these scenes of her living in this isolated little shack on the island, and doing her work and having more flashbacks. And it's kind of like, okay, we get it. We get it. And I would also say this, Craig, I'm kind of to the point now where, look, it's good to see a movie like this, but how many more alcoholism movies can we see? What new ground can we tread on with a movie like this? We've kind of seen it all before with The Lost Weekend and Barfly and Leaving Las Vegas, Days of Wine and Roses with Jack Lemmon and Lee Remick, one of the best films ever made about alcoholism, Come Fill the Cup, Jimmy Cagney, of course, all the Star is Born movies, you know, the recent one with Bradley Cooper. He played a man drunk as well as anybody, as any actor I've ever seen do it, because he didn't do it over the top, you know, like we kind of see in old movies. But there's a point where it's like, okay, hit rock bottom, go to rehab, recover. It's the same film over and over, and I don't know how many more ways there are to tell it, but at least we have an interesting setting. She's out there looking at these birds. She's trying to get her life back together. It's a great performance. But I think what hurts it in the end is it's just too long for the subject matter, and we've kind of seen it all before. But overall, I would slightly recommend it for Ronan's performance and the cinematography.
So, Matt, this was based on a novel.
It is.
Of the same name. And are you telling me then that there really isn't anything unique about her life story that really grabbed you?
Like I said, I think the setting is what makes it. Ronan's performance and the setting up on this isolated island. She kind of eventually lives in this little, it's almost like a shack, and she's living alone and trying to work on her sobriety. So all that is interesting, but I think a friend of mine were chatting about this afterwards. I think in the end, it's hard to reinvent the wheel with a movie about alcoholism. It's kind of like biopics. It follows that same bouncy ball, you know, hit rock bottom, go to rehab, recover, lose sobriety again, recover. It's kind of the same beat. You know what I'm saying, Craig? It's the same beat like in a biopic where someone hits stardom, hits rock bottom, comes back.
I was wondering whether the fact that she returns home would add anything to the movie, because quite frankly, every time now that I go home, when I go back to Wyoming, you know, I think about stuff, Matt. I think about things that, mm-hmm. that happened early in our lives and family and friends and all of those things. You're saying that that also really doesn't add enough to the movie to really make it stand out.
It adds something to it. Now, had this film just been set in London, I think it would have been a much weaker film. The fact that she goes home to this isolated island that really moviegoers have not seen too much in movies. I've seen a few movies that are set in the Orkneys, but I think that adds to it. So let me say that it does add to the movie. I just think in the end, the film is too long.
Sure.
And I agree with you. You know, when I go home to Oaks, you know, there was a lot of drinking and alcohol growing up, you know, in a small town, and I don't need to draw your roadmap. And it's kind of this love-hate thing. Like, I love my small town, but boy, there was a lot of drinking going on. And so I think that kind of makes it more interesting for me to watch a movie like this, because I saw friends kind of get into alcohol badly, you know, and it ruined their lives. So it's always there. And you just, you know, I thank my lucky stars. When I walk out of a movie like this, I thank my lucky stars I never had the addiction gene. You know, I can have a couple beers and I can go home. But that's not the way it is for everyone. So it's good to have movies like this. And I like the setting. I love Ronan. She's an amazing actress. I don't know what more can be said about this topic.
Let's move on to our Academy Award trivia moment. Matt, you've mentioned this movie in this review. The actor won a Best Actor Oscar, and it had to do with addiction. Who was that actor and when was the movie made?
I'm guessing you're thinking of The Lost Weekend, 1945, with Ray Milland winning the Oscar.
I was thinking of Leaving Las Vegas.
Oh, well, I'm sorry. Yeah, well, so
Nicolas Cage.
So I mentioned two movies here that both got Best Actor. Yeah, Nick Cage wins Best Actor 1995 for Leaving Las Vegas, right?
Matt, we're going to review a movie next week that I am really looking forward to see what you have to say about it. Let our listeners in.
Saturday Night. So Jason Reitman directs kind of a, it takes place in one night, that fall of 1975, as they're trying to get the first ever show of Saturday Night Live on the air. And now 49 years later, it's still going. So it looks, you know, so far the buzz on it is really good, but we'll see. I'll be the judge, right?
And you always do a great job of that for our listeners here at Prairie Public. Matt
thanks.
Olean reviews movies with us each and every Thursday. Matt, thanks for joining us.
You bet.
More Main Streets ahead. Stay with us.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Dr. Julie Peterman Bryant of the Bryant Clinic of Chiropractic and Acupuncture in Bismarck. Naturally working with people to feel better, be healthy, and live well at all ages.
This is Dakota Datebook for October 17th. When the United States entered World War I in April 1917, suspicion fell on German Americans. Anti-German sentiment led to the prohibition of teaching German in schools, the closure of many German language newspapers, and persecution for speaking German in public or on the phone. Many German Americans suffered from this unfair prejudice. North Dakota had a significant population of people of German descent, the largest being the Germans from Russia, who numbered about 70,000. Many of them farmed in close-knit communities in the south-central region of the state. Professor Alfred Koenig of the University of Minnesota was born in Germany in 1885 and came to the United States around 1904. He joined the University of Minnesota in 1909 to teach German. His parents and siblings still lived in Germany and suffered greatly after World War I began in 1914. Four of his brothers died fighting in the German army. His father became a political prisoner, and his mother died from despair. Professor Koenig was determined to serve his new country. On this date, in 1917, the Fargo Forum announced that he would soon be arriving in North Dakota to speak to German-speaking communities about the importance of America's efforts in the war and to raise funds for the Red Cross. Koenig took on his mission with enthusiasm. In just 30 days, he visited 10 counties and gave 98 speeches, mostly in German. In some of the communities he visited, he was greeted by mayors and bands. His talks were well attended, and most attendees donated to the Red Cross after hearing him speak. Koenig was pleased with the outcome of his trip and believed that the German Americans he met were loyal. He empathized with their ties to their homeland, especially those who had family fighting in Germany. He stated, "In many districts, I found the people unfamiliar with the real facts of the war situation. Ignorance of what the war is about is often interpreted as disloyalty." Koenig returned to North Dakota many times to continue speaking with German-speaking communities and became very popular.
In June 1918, 600 people attended a speech he gave in Fessenden. After the war, Koenig left the university to develop the Americanization program for the YMCA. He continued assisting immigrants through the YMCA until his death in 1933. Today's Dakota Datebook, written by Trista Razor Sturza. I'm Ann Alquist.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
We'd like to thank the North Dakota Council on the Arts for supporting arts programming here on Prairie Public.
And that's a wrap for this edition of Main Street. We are grateful that you have chosen to spend time with us. Thank you. Tomorrow at 3 p.m. Central, it's The Middle with host Jeremy Hobson. Jeremy's topic this week, what do you want the next president to do about our economy? And Ira Flatow will have Science Friday, and we'll air it. That's at 7 p.m. Central on Friday. From all of us here at Prairie Public, we hope you have a great North Dakota weekend, and we'll see you again next week right here on Main Street.